Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the Bechdel cast, the questions asked if movies have women in them. Are all their discussions just boyfriends and husbands, or do they have individualism? The patriarchy's effing vast. Start changing it with the Bechdel cast.
Caitlin.
Yes, Jamie?
I've got a problem and it needs solving.
Okay.
I only have 90 minutes to record a podcast.
Okay, so mine was going to be, whoever hears this, I suppose you'll think it's a confession. I recorded this podcast. Me, Caitlin Durante. I did it for the money and a woman. And I didn't get the money and I didn't get the woman.
Okay, I like that way better. I like that way better.
Because what is Walter Neff doing at the beginning of this movie and throughout besides recording a true crime podcast?
He literally... Yes, I wrote down the same thing. I was like, wow. What's her name? I wrote down who's the whatever, the cereal person. I'm blowing it this morning.
Oh my gosh, I don't remember either.
Why? I feel like everyone, I can hear her voice, I can hear her cadence. It's iconic. Like I was very into it when it came out. What was it? Sarah Koenig.
Yes.
He's Sarah Koeniging out at the beginning of the show.
Wow. That was one of our best intros.
Perfect. See, this is, and if people are listening right now, this is why we don't record this early in the morning, because this is going to be you're going to feel us sort of waking up as the podcast proceeds. We're not like Walter Neff recording in the dead of night with an injury.
With a gunshot wound. Yeah. It's 10 a.m. I've been up since 7 because I needed to rewatch this movie
same,
this morning.
Same. So I think that we're doing a really good job so far. Welcome to the Bechdel cast. My name's Jamie Loftus.
My name is Caitlin Durante, and this is our show where we examine movies through an intersectional feminist lens using the Bechdel test simply as a jumping off point, an inspiration for us to get a conversation going.
Yes.
Jamie.
Uh-huh.
Tell me what the Bechdel test is, please.
No. Okay. The Bechdel test has many permutations. It's sometimes called the Bechdel-Wallace test, originally created by queer cartoonist Alison Bechdel. We require that to pass, you have to have two characters of a marginalized gender with names speaking to each other about something other than a man for more than two lines of dialogue. I think this movie passes, which is funny because I went in thinking there's no way there's even a second woman in the movie. Well, guess what? There is exactly one woman. So egg on my face. There's two women in the movie and they talk about checkers.
Yes, they do.
So if that's why you listen to the podcast, I guess you could turn it off now because it does. But stick around because we got a lot of exciting stuff to talk about. We're covering a film noir today from 1940, 1944.
Yeah.
Called Double Indemnity. And we have an amazing returning guest. Let's get her in the mix.
We certainly do. She is a media critic. You remember her from our episode on Point Break. It's Anita Sarkeesian.
Hello.
Welcome back.
Welcome back.
Okay, just so everyone knows, I tried to get them to do another surf movie with me so that I only do surf movies on the Bechdel cast, and they were not going for it. Caitlin, like, just looked at me being like, nobody requests surf movies.
I don't think
that's true, so please write in and let them know that I'm right.
I didn't know about this conversation, and I would have made a strong argument for Blue Crush. That movie really gave me some body problems. So,
yeah, I forgot about Blue Crush.
Oh, how could you forget about Blue Crush?
I've never seen Blue Crush, so I like this would be a great opportunity because I'm like, I want to watch all of them now, so I will. I'll come back. And apparently it was formative for a lot of young queers, too. There's a whole, I need to get in on this.
I remember there was such a frothing culture around Blue Crush because all the girls that I would watch it with were like, isn't it amazing that Kate Bosworth has one blue eye and one brown eye? We were just like all lusting after her. We're like, wow, her bikini's so low cut. Yeah, there's a whole thing.
Yeah, exactly.
To be said there. Wow. But we're talking about Double Indemnity. We're talking about a different kind of interestingly exploited female character today. It's Femme Fatale Day on the Bechdel cast.
It sure is. So, Anita, what is your relationship, history, etc., with this movie, with film noir in general?
Nothing. I have no history at all. I chose it, or like I, you know, kind of agreed to do it because I've been curious about going back and watching older films. So I was like, why not have an excuse to do it? I sort of regret that choice. So this is going to be a great episode. but I don't know. I didn't know anything about this movie going into it. I loosely knew that it was like kind of quintessential in terms of establishing the femme fatale or film noir-ish kind of vibes. So I was curious about that. But I don't have a long history of like, you know, it's not like I've watched a bunch of noirs. I kind of get the sense of them. I find current or more modern films that pull noir themes really interesting. But that makes it like, every time I watch a movie that's like, this was the thing that changed everything, I always feel a little bit of, we will never be able to know what that feels like because I've seen every iteration since then, or I've seen every like derivative. Mm. I've seen everything that is like derivative from the original source. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way. It's just, it's so hard sometimes to put yourself in the mind of the viewer at the time and the creation process at the time.
Right. I'm sure that if I had seen Citizen Kane in whatever 1941 when it came out, I'd be like, wow, this movie's so cool, look at how groundbreaking it is, look at how it changed cinema. But I didn't see it in 1941. I saw it in the mid-2000s and I hate it.
Well, that was your first mistake, not being alive in 1941.
I do want to cover Citizen Kane someday so I can just talk about how it's a turd, but that's a different episode.
Edgelord Caitlin peeking her little head out.
But I do think, kind of before we get into this a little bit, so I just watched Licorice Pizza, which has a extremely racist, a couple of moments of like deep racism, right?
Yeah.
And I was thinking about, I don't have anything really insightful to say about this, but that it can be very hard for modern progressive viewers to go back and watch older films, right? Because you do have to kind of, in order to do that and to appreciate the craft of the time, we have to acknowledge, sit through, deal with, ignore, like whatever it is that you do when you watch older movies, it's just there, right? And you can't unsee what you know.
Right, right.
And I was thinking about what that means in contemporary films, especially contemporary films that are of a time. So like including pieces that are super racist or sexist in a movie that comes out in 2021 to contextualize the moment that it takes place. Like,
right.
Anyway, I have a lot of thoughts about that. And I think that there's something interesting about like kind of me ping ponging back and forth in right now and what I'm watching and seeing like, cool, I got to like deal with, you know, you got to deal with the like all the sexist representations and the like light misogyny that's just like a part of the environment. And then also we still have to, you know, it's still being justified as relevant or a part of the craft or a part of the art or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's like a period piece, right?
Yeah.
It's not the only, you know, I'm not like specifically calling out PTA, but just the, you know, like Tarantino and like they all fucking do that, right?
Right.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes like period pieces are used as an excuse to like bring that back in a way of like, isn't this funny? And you're like, it's really not. Mm-hmm. But I think femme fatale is like such an interesting thing. And I totally agree with what you guys are saying of it's so difficult to watch a movie and put yourself in the like mindset of an audience member at the time. It's like almost impossible unless you're like really, really, really trying to. And that's like part of what's hard about this show sometimes. Yeah.
But that's the thing is like what audience is watching it as well, I think is another piece to that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Jamie, what's your relationship to Double Indemnity?
I saw this movie in college. I think that like any person that went through a bad film program, like there was a unit on noir. I saw a bunch of them. I generally do like I like noir and I really like noir like parody and like comedy. I'm like into the vibe of noir mm-hmm. and because the characters are so clear. And so I enjoy watching noir. Also, my friend of the show, guest on our Gigli episode, Josh Fadum, just observed Noirvember, which is something he does every year for nobody. But this year I was paying attention. And so I had noir on the brain anyways. So I was excited to revisit this movie because I feel like this movie is often kind of presented as like the blueprint for a lot of noir tropes and particularly like the femme fatale character.
Right.
And it was kind of interesting to come back to because by coincidence, I was working on the Kathy podcast this year. And so was going through the history of like American women's rights. And so it was like interesting to have a few things click about like why the femme fatale trope tends to pop at certain moments. It makes total sense that it would pop during World War II because it's a time where women are taking on men's jobs, quote unquote, and are mm-hmm. presenting a more active threat to the status quo. And so femme fatales like popping in the 40s and 50s makes total sense. Anytime that there's like a period of time where there's a backlash to a popular feminist movement, you get these characters that are like variations on witches and like evil women luring people with sex. And I don't know. I genuinely like movie wise, I hear like Walter Neff is such a doofus. Like he got a boner one time and was ready to just throw his entire life away, which is kind of funny. But I'm excited to talk about this movie. I genuinely enjoyed watching it. And Barbara Stanwyck is such an icon. And she's wearing such a bizarre wig. It's very distracting.
The bangs on her bangs are out of control.
They're like hard. They look like you could like knock on them.
They're like a perfect cylinder just resting atop her forehead. I don't understand how you accomplish that.
Unbelievable. But yeah, I mean, there's misogynist tropes abound in this genre, but I think it like in context, it's pretty interesting and the movies are fun to watch.
Yeah. I too saw this movie in college at least a couple times and then also in grad school where I did get a master's degree in screenwriting from Boston University. I hate to mention it, but...
Wait, they made you watch it again?
Yeah, I mean, because I took like enough like film theory or film history classes that touched on film noir and this is kind of one of those like quintessential film noir movies. It's cited as having set the standard for film noir. So, you know, it's kind of one of the ones to study if you're developing the curriculum for a very standard, boring film class because they always show the same damn movies over and over again. So I've seen it several times in school. And
this is like, I feel like the one that they show in school.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is also why I've seen Citizen Kane 800 times. Right. And I hate it more and more every time I see it. Anyway, I'll stop bringing up Citizen Kane, maybe. But yeah, so I've seen this movie a number of times, usually, and I probably like maybe I saw it once just of my own volition before I saw it for a class, because I was like, oh yeah, this is one of those like famous movies that's in all the textbooks. I have to see it so I can, you know, be smart and understand references.
So you could go to party. Right. Sometimes I just watch things so I can comfortably attend a party.
Same.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah.
But I don't hate the movie. I like the snappy dialogue, you know.
The aesthetic is fun.
I generally like film noir. I like neo-noir especially, but.
Well, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, baby?
I mean, come on.
The noir golden standard. I think I'm serious too. I think I'm serious in it.
I don't think you're wrong.
Yeah,
we covered that movie a while back on the Matreon. So
sure,
if you haven't heard it, listeners, go check it out. But anyway, should I do the recap and then we'll discuss?
Let's do it.
Okay. Actually, let's take a quick break first, and then we will be right back.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, CentraTech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
And we're back. So, Double Indemnity. We meet Walter Neff, played by Fred McMurray. He is an insurance salesman who stumbles into his office and starts recording a podcast, basically. He starts recording a confession to Mr. Keyes, who we will later learn is a colleague of Walter Neff's. He confesses that he murdered someone named Dietrichson. He did it for the money and a woman, but he didn't get either. He mentions a double indemnity, and we're like, wow, that's the name of the movie.
I was like, I hope he defines that in dialogue at some point, and then he does, which yes. I genuinely needed. So thank you,
same.
Walter.
Yes. And then he starts to tell the story about how all of this transpired. And then we flash back to Walter paying Mr. Dietrichson a visit at his Los Angeles home to talk about his expired car insurance policy. Mr. Dietrichson is not home, but his wife, Mrs. Dietrichson, a.k.a. Phyllis, played by Barbara Stanwyck, is home. She comes out all sexy and not fully clothed. She's got like a towel draped on her.
Yeah, they really need to signal to you what's going on right away. I did like that they like just like old timey ways of objectifying a woman are funny, where he kept being like, her anklet. And you're like,
yeah,
you're a pervert. Stop talking about her anklet.
In that moment, too, when he first meets her and she was sunbathing, he says, I hope there aren't any pigeons. Like, it's just right. These like lines that I was like, what the fuck is this comedy?
Like, I was like, this, I would almost rather someone, I mean, I would rather Walter Neff never speak to me. But if he had to, I just that roundabout, it's just creepy. Where he's like, oh, I hope there's no pigeons.
Just, like, I hope birds aren't shitting on you. Is that what? I
guess so.
And then right after, the housekeeper says, like, the living room is where they keep the liquor locked up, which is also a weird thing. And he says, that's all right, I always carry my own keys. Like, some of the dialogue in this, I kept being like, what the fuck? Yeah, I don't even understand it.
It's another, I'm adjusting the name of this test. I need to figure it out. But it is an example of, if the actor saying that line wasn't extremely conventionally hot, you'd be like, this guy is weird. Why is he acting like this?
Yes, yes. I think part of it is like the writer's attempt to have like really quippy, clever dialogue in a way that might have made more sense to like 1940s audiences. But, you know, many decades later, we're like, what are you talking about? I think it's a combination of that and a lot of the dialogue has to be euphemism to
get past the haze,
like
code.
Skirt the restrictions of the production code.
Right.
So
I like it. I think it's just so bizarre to hear characters talk like that to each other and feel like it's just another day right. Talking like a weirdo.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So Phyllis Dietrichson agrees to chat with Walter Neff, and he spends that entire conversation hitting on her in a very 1940s way. And then she asks if he handles accident insurance, which he does. And she tells him to come back at a different time when her husband will be home. Then we see Walter at his office. We meet Keyes, who is Walter Neff's colleague. His whole thing is that he's a skeptic and he can always sniff out a fraudulent insurance claim.
Because he feels it right here. And he like basically like points to his like torso. I was like, what are you doing? Is this some weird dick thing? Like, it was very, and I was like, oh, your heart. Like your heart and your gut. It was so, yeah. It's like, okay, buddy.
Yeah, he keeps referring to the little man who lives inside him.
Oh, that, yes, that was the thing.
Yeah.
And you're like, is this a euphemism? What's happening here? I don't understand. Yeah.
He's like, I always know when someone's lying to me, I can feel it in my dick.
When my dick starts to throb, that's when you know someone's not telling the truth. I really like that moment with him. I mean, who is that character? I don't think I've ever seen that character actor before.
Edward G. Robinson.
Yeah, apparently he was quite famous back in the day, but don't really know him.
Oh, no. Oh, he named people during the Red Scare. Oh, you little asshole.
Boo. Fuck him.
He named Dalton Trumbo. Wow. Okay, this bitch. Okay. So, all right.
Fuck you and your little man.
I this Wikipedia page. Yeah, go fuck yourself. Oh, your dick's throbbing, then you out. Good-hearted communists. Jesus. Okay. Keyes, the character.
Yes.
I really enjoyed that scene where, kind of like apropos of nothing, he just is like, yeah, I almost got married once. Didn't work out though. Like, he just starts going off about how he's never been loved in his life and that's why he's so good at insurance. I was like, oh my God.
Also, the reasons he lists for like not going through with that marriage are so wild. And again, you know, the standards of the time were very different, but he's like, I found out that she used to dye her hair, or that she's been dyeing her hair since she was 16. And also, she was married once before. And then he also like,
oh no,
makes a reference to how there's like mental illness in her family. So he's like, and then Walter's like, yeah, I get it. She was a tramp. Everyone in her family is a tramp, blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, yikes. Your standards are very, mean.
This guy was so dirty at the House of Un-American Activities Committee.
What a piece of shit.
What an asshole. He thought, and again, of the time, I'm sure he's like, oh, this is, we don't have time to talk about this today. I'm disappointed, Edward. RIP, he died like 500 years ago.
Fun fact, sometime next year, I'll be releasing a video series, and one of the episodes is about the Hollywood blacklist. So,
ooh,
no way.
Tune into that whenever the fuck that appears.
Yeah, keep your eyes peeled, listeners.
Please fillet a fish our boy Edward, because he fucked up. He fucked up big time.
All right, so we've met Keyes. Then Walter Neff goes back to Phyllis Dietrichson, who tells him that she wants to take out an accident insurance policy on her husband, who works a dangerous job in the oil fields. But she doesn't want her husband to know about it. And Walter automatically assumes that it's because she's trying to find a way to get her husband killed so that she can collect on the insurance money. Mm-hmm. But she's like, no, IDK, what you're talking about? But even so, he storms out. But then he's like, oh, wait a minute, though. She's so hot.
I mean, she wears an anklet.
She wears an anklet.
Like, I mean.
He brings it up like 4 or 5 times.
It's like, really weird.
He's like, yeah, the way the anklet was cutting into your leg. I'm like, no.
Pass.
Okay, so he comes back and like, anyways, I'm just using this as a cue to talk about the like the dialogue-y banter, right? That's very not the way that people talk.
Right.
And I haven't watched a lot of movies from the 40s, but it is very much the sort of stereotype that I think we think of when we think about like older films.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I found it really hard to watch. You know, and you both expressed that like you enjoyed it and like thought it was kind of a fun thing. And for me, it, like it got really exhausting after a while.
Oh, definitely.
You know, like it was just too, I was like, can y'all just fucking like, and again, film history like has changed so much in terms of what we expect of actors and storytelling and all of that. But I was just getting really like, okay, enough already with the performativeness of this conversation, right?
It definitely gave me whiplash after a while because there's that scene where he's like, suppose I am speeding. And she's like, well, suppose I give you a ticket. And suppose you leave me off with a warning. And suppose it doesn't take. And I'm just like, ugh.
See, that just makes me laugh where they're like flirting. You're like, this is, I barely recognize this as the English language. Like, what are you guys talking about? And then at the end, they're like, we have a crush on each other. I'm like, from based
what?
Off of that? Interesting. Okay.
So it also reminds me, and like, okay, Joss Whedon's a piece of shit. So acknowledging that before I go into this, but it reminds me of how like Buffy and some of the work that he did in the 90s and 2000s sort of popularized that kind of like, and I'd say Gilmore Girls too, kind of popularized that like, it feels like a remnant of that time.
Yeah.
But kind of normal, like that I didn't have a problem with. Right? Like I didn't like Gilmore Girls, but so it feels a little bit like that.
Right.
I'm just like, it's not like we don't do that anymore, but it's modernized in a way that's like our jokes and our communication and our, you know, like sort of hyper communication of the moment. But man, I was really, by the end of it, I was like, can you just stop talking?
I'm a sucker for people talking real fast. And so anytime someone's talking real fast, I'm like, oh yeah, okay, cool. What? Huh?
Like but that's also YouTube life, right? Like the joke about YouTubers is that they all talk super fast because we used to have time constraints. So we're trying to like shove everything in. Uh-huh. So I think it's just interesting how like that kind of maybe like ebbed and flowed a little bit in terms of the way that what we accept as like witty dialogue and speed of talking changes, or our perception of it in the past changes too, right? And it's all like the mid-Atlantic kind of fake fucking accents and shit where you're like, this is not real.
I mean, there's also like, there's like movie dialogue that you like read it on the page or you hear it and you're like, this is dialogue, versus something that feels more realistic and organic and conversational, which like also can be very well written. But I don't know, I'm kind of a sucker for dialogue that no one would actually say in real life, because it's like very clearly written. It's like too clever and too quick.
Like,
and
Aaron Sorkin, like the West Wing kind of.
Oh,
I know.
Yeah, that's the flavor I don't
like. But I'm saying it's that kind of thing where you're like, this isn't real, but also like you kind of, like a lot of people really vibe with it, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like, yeah, there's probably like a fast talking genre or like piece of work for every like generation that it's like either you're into it or you're not, or
right,
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I do also want to add that if I literally in my notes I wrote, if he says baby one more time,
oh my gosh.
Like, I here's the thing is Walter Neff, Fred McMurray, like, it's just so unlikable in every conceivable way. There's nothing about him.
I'm glad you feel that way, because I was like, I'm not interested in this man at all. Mm-hmm. He's, not for me.
I think I would have liked the movie more if I gave any fucks at all about this guy, but he just seemed so unlikable and so uninteresting and such a piece of shit in every way that, like, I don't feel bad that he's being manipulated. I don't feel bad that he is like,
no,
he's like, I want you to fail and I want you to get like,
right,
you know, whatever. And so I think that I don't think as an audience member, we're supposed to feel that way about him.
No, I think the movie, because he was prior to this like a rom-com star, and he almost turned down the role because he's like, this role is going to tarnish my reputation as a like an America's sweetheart, you know, like rom-com guy. But then he went for it anyway. But yeah, I think he as an actor, people liked him and we are meant to be endeared to him. But yeah, again, by like my standards today, I'm just like, ew, quit calling her baby 800 times.
Yeah, I didn't really, I don't know what it was. And I'm like, maybe this is just me being annoying, but I'm like, if there was a different actor in that role. But the other thing is, with noir characters in general, I guess I don't understand from a writing perspective why you wouldn't give the audience more information about who Walter Neff is, or like what, because it just seems like he's living this like stakesless life. Like,
right,
he's a single guy. We don't know anything about his family. He seems like he's financially comfortable enough, but we don't really know anything about him. And so it's hard to, like, I feel like if they just added one or two details of like, and he has a sick cat, or like just something to like endear you to him, or just to give information. But he's just like a guy. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I was like, well, I don't really care what happens to this guy. He's just some guy.
When in the history of film noir did it become kind of attached to the sort of hard-boiled detective?
Mm.
Because that, so this movie is this like femme fatale manipulating this guy, right? Is kind of, mm-hmm, the vibes that are happening. But in my mind, being very uneducated in this space, I'm like, well, shouldn't he be a little more hard-boiled and a little more like gruff? Right.
I think that ordinarily that is the case of like, there's more gruffness. You'll have a little bit more information about the character, which is kind of just like Walter's whole character kind of strikes me as a little bizarre, because I'm just like, I feel like I don't know who this person is. Mm-hmm. So I can't even like from a like, oh, I feel bad for this guy. Like, I don't really feel bad for him because he seems to know exactly what's going on outside of the fact that she is manipulated. Like, that's the only thing he doesn't know. But everything else, there's so many plot developments in this murder plot that are like his idea. So I'm like, yeah, he's gonna get what's coming to him. Like, it's not
right.
Like, she's like, oh, we should do this or we should do this, which she does sometimes. She's obviously an active participant in this plot. But his whole thing where they're like, oh no, we actually have to throw your husband off a train and then we'll get twice the money. And I was like, okay, so he's just like a full-on,
which,
collusion, like, goofus, and I don't care what happens to him.
And I don't think that they, and you already said this, Jamie, but they don't do a good enough job of showing that they fucking care about each other. And I know that there's the bit at the end, well, we're not there yet, we'll deal with it when,
right,
whatever, but like, we're not supposed to think that she really cares that much about him, right? We're supposed to, like, she's manipulating, right, him, and she's, like, going along with it, and he's in love with her, but, like, they don't do anything to really build that relationship or the emotional stakes of it in any way. And so,
but he calls her baby. So that's how we know that he loves her? There's those
long montages. Yeah, there's all these opportunities And I get like story logic. I'm like, okay, that makes sense. But also I wouldn't have been bothered as an audience member when there's just like, they'll have one conversation and then there'll be a montage where he's like, and then I didn't see her for 2 weeks and I kind of just went back to what I was doing. And I was like, well, that's boring. That doesn't, right. I don't really care.
Ugh, yeah. There's a whole conversation to be had about like his motive or lack thereof. It's wild.
I think his motive is that he's horny. Like, yeah, I think seriously, that's it.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I've had a horny motive in my day, but not, sure, you know, not to this extent.
Doesn't drive you to murder.
And I've got a personality, unlike Walter. So it's interesting when I have a horny motive.
Yeah, right? Okay, so wait, where did we leave off?
I like when he goes bowling on the way home. Oh, sorry. Yeah. I was like, that is again, like, just a creepy, bizarre thing to do. Like, I gotta blow some steam off.
Hey, that's character development.
he likes bowling
alone.
I also wondered if that was a euphemism for something, like if that was understood that if you go bowling after work, it's really like, did he go to a bar and get
jerking
like
off.
Drunk? I don't know.
You have a beer and go bowling alone. Yeah, that's. Yeah, you get drunk at your house and jerk off.
Right. Okay, so he's kind of having conflicting thoughts because he's like, I don't want to, you know, be involved with her, but she's so hot, so I don't know. And then she pays him a visit and basically confirms that his suspicions were correct about her wanting to have her husband killed. And she reveals that it's because her husband is abusive toward her. Mm-hmm. Walter and Phyllis kiss. Then Walter is like, you know, you probably won't get away with this, but with my help and know-how as an insurance guy, maybe you will get away with it. So then they start to scheme. First, they need to trick Mr. Dietrichson into signing the policy, and they need a witness, which ends up being Dietrichson's daughter from his first marriage, Lola. So he signs the policy. Then Walter's like, oh, by the way, if we do a double indemnity, which is when...
And then we go, woohoo, yeah. The title.
Which is when the insurance pays out double on certain accidents. For example, if someone is killed on a train, in which case for this policy, they would stand to make $100,000 in the event of Mr. Dietrichson's death. So they're like, let's cash in on that.
Which is like a bajillion dollars in 1944 money.
Right, yes. So they arrange for Mr. Dietrichson to take a train on his upcoming trip to Palo Alto. But before that happens, Mr. Dietrichson falls and breaks his leg and calls off the trip. So Phyllis is freaking out, but Walter's like, it's cool. We just got to be patient. And then also Walter and Phyllis are having an affair throughout this whole thing. And he keeps calling her baby and it's gross.
Yeah, that's how you know that they're in love, because they kiss 2 times and he calls her baby 1,000,000 times.
Yes.
And that's...
That's love.
That's how love works.
Yes. So Walter tries to take his mind off the whole thing. A week or so passes. And then one day he gets a call from Phyllis saying that her husband is taking the train that night. So this is their chance.
Another thing that just I thought was like bizarre and fun when I was reading about the way that this movie was written, because Raymond Chandler was a co-writer on this, was that he like, I guess he spent a lot of time in L.A. trying to like get a feel for, but like this movie, a lot of the moments feel like that SNL sketch where they can't stop talking about traffic and intersections, because there's so many times where the characters are so specific about like what street in LA they're going to like go roller skating, or it's like, yeah, I'm going to Formosa and Santa Monica, blah, 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 blah.
And like, her house is on Los Feliz Boulevard. I was like, this is not, that's not what that looks like.
Right.
I was like, did it look like that? I don't know.
But yeah, it is very like, this is LA, but it doesn't like, I wouldn't put it in an LA category of like, if you want to watch movies about LA, because it didn't feel like LA in any way other than the names of streets.
I just thought it was like funny that they like felt that it almost felt like a self-conscious reflex to be like, we're definitely here. And we know the names of the streets too.
Right. Okay. So that night, Walter does a bunch of things to establish his alibi. Then Walter kills Mr. Dietrichson as Phyllis drives him to the train station. And then Walter gets on the train pretending to be Mr. Dietrichson and jumps off the train and fakes the accident. And then they put Mr. Dietrichson's dead body on the tracks. And it seems like everything went according to plan, but Walter can't help but feel something's wrong, or that, like, you know, he's going to be found out or something.
Mm-hmm.
In the days that follow, the police find Mr. Dietrichson's body. They rule it an accidental death. But then Walter's boss, whose name is Edward Norton, by the way.
yeah. I also was like, oh.
He's pissed that the company is going to have to pay out all the money on Dietrichson's policy. And he's certain the death was not an accident. He thinks it was a suicide. Mm. So he calls in Phyllis, who says, like, that's ridiculous. My husband didn't die by suicide. And Keyes, who again is a skeptic, believes that the death was an accident at first. So it looks like Walter and Phyllis are going to get the $100,000 payout. But then Keyes is like, wait a minute. If Mr. Dietrichson knew he had accident insurance, why didn't he do anything when he broke his leg? So then Keyes gets to thinking the whole thing was a setup.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Phyllis and Walter are freaking out. The whole situation is tearing their relationship apart. Then the daughter, Lola, pays Walter a visit and tells him that she suspects Phyllis murdered her mother several years back.
I like Lola. She's a smart cookie. People got to take Lola more seriously.
Oh my God. The amount that she gets gaslit by Walter in this movie, and then he starts dating her basically to distract her.
I know.
It's really gross.
Is it ever stated how old she is? I feel like it's heavily implied that she is a teenager. Like, she's in school. So, she's going roller skating. She needs permission from her dad to go places.
I was really curious about this, so I found the screenplay that was written in the 40s.
Whoa.
To see if it said, and it does say how old she is. She is 19, according to the screenplay.
That's convenient.
Well, right.
I guess that is... I love in creepy movies where they're like, hi, I'm 18, so this creepy thing that's about to happen is totally legal.
You're like, right, and then she turns to the camera. She's like, I'm 18, recently. And like, you're just like, oh my God. That is interesting that they felt the need to specify. And by interesting, I mean weird.
Right. Yeah. So
either way, whatever.
I mean, it's still creepy because they start dating and he's 35 and she's 19. And
it's under false pretenses. Like, there's so much about it.
And there's this whole other boyfriend too, Zucchetti, right, is in the works here.
Who's not looking particularly 19 years old to me.
And also, speaking of like male toxic behaviors, when we meet Zucchetti, he is just like, who's this guy? You're with me. You can't be with this guy. He can't know about me. And it was just like really aggressive. And she's like, no, baby, I love you. And you're like, what the fuck is happening?
Like, you just worry for this poor girl. And she's been through so much. Yeah. And like, it did make me laugh when the Zucchetti guy was like, I don't have friends. I'm like, well, no shit.
We can see
dude.
Why. Yeah.
Yeah. You're a little abrasive.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that when he starts dating her, I was like, this can't be happening. And like, we've had age gap conversations on the show before. I don't think we need to get into it today. But like, this one, there's a pretty obvious no thank you.
Right. So Lola thinks that Phyllis killed her father now, too. So Walter is like gaslighting her and distracting her so that she like doesn't tell anyone else about it. Keyes, meanwhile, is piecing things together more and more. Basically, he has the whole crime figured out, except for who pulled it off.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't yet know that it was Walter. And because Keyes is like getting so close to the truth, Walter wants to distance himself from Phyllis, especially because he also continues to see Lola, and especially because he finds out that Phyllis has been having an affair with Lola's former boyfriend, Nino Zucchetti.
So he does have a friend.
Right. So then Walter goes to confront Phyllis. She shoots him, but he doesn't die right away. And he gets the gun and shoots her and kills her. And then he goes to his office and starts the confession that we saw him recording at the beginning, except Keyes comes in and overhears. So Walter tries to leave. He wants to escape across the border, but he dies from his gunshot wound before he can even get out of the building. And that's how the movie ends. So let's take a quick break and then we will come back to discuss.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Johnny B. Goode, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
And we're back.
Okay, can we talk about femme fatales just for a minute?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, please.
So I dragged Caitlin out to watch Batman Returns, the best movie that's ever been made recently. And when I left the movie, I was thinking about how my feminist analysis has become much more nuanced and more open to things like Catwoman. Mm-hmm. Whereas sure. I, like 10 years ago, I would have been like, this sexist piece of shit, da 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 da, right? So I was thinking about this with femme fatales because, like, on the surface, and maybe not the surface, but this is kind of what I wanted to chat with you about, is like they seem incredibly sexist representations, right? And Jamie, you started us talking about like films and like narrative media often bring out these anxieties that are coming around at the times that they're being created. And so, you know, like it's exhausting to be like this manipulative woman who's just trying to get money and kill her husband. And like a lot of femme fatales is that kind of like women are sneaky and duplicitous and they use their sexual wiles to like get men to do things for them. Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is there like in your minds, is there any nuance to this? Is there any way in which that is like salvageable as not fucked up?
I think that it's like... It depends. I mean, I don't have like I don't know how you feel, Caitlin, but I don't have like a hard answer to that. I think that the more context I had for why these characters were so popular when they were so popular, kind of clarified how I felt about it. Because I do think it's like ultimately it is a, I think it's like the kind of misogynist trope that is easily reclaimable, but was not intended to be reclaimable. It's like very much a clear like. The most heterosexual white dudes in the world are writing this at a time where women were, I guess, unusually able to access money and capital and power during World War II. And so I feel like it's just like calcifying that anxiety and selling it back to men who were feeling the same way. I do think that there is an angle to reclaim the femme fatale that has been kind of reclaimed in some neo-noir movies because, and I think like I didn't remember this particular detail about this movie, but the fact that Phyllis, you know, they include the detail that Phyllis is being abused by her husband. And so I feel like
there's an in right there for like.
But is that true?
Well, we got to get revenge.
Like, but that's the thing is she's so manipulative that why would you believe that?
That's true. I had that thought too, where I was like, is that part of, because in addition to like using her sexual wiles and, you know, her feminine wiles and her sexuality and exploiting that to deceive and seduce men, the femme fatale archetype also is just like flat out lying and using deceit to get what she wants. And it did occur to me, like, is that the case? Like, when she reveals that her husband is abusive,
right?
Is that actually true? Which very well could be the case. But because we don't see it on screen, we don't see the abuse, it does make you wonder, like, is that part of her deceit? We don't really know for sure.
Right. I mean, I guess that I believed it. Maybe I'm a Walter, too. But I believed it because you saw all of the other behaviors that she was describing in that conversation. You did see him, like, he was drinking a lot during the day. He was dismissive of her. He was belligerent towards her. He was dismissive of his daughter. And so because that was sort of where I was going, where I was like, well, it seems like, you know, it wasn't like she was like, he's this awful piece of shit. And then you met this very sweet husband who was very in love with her. Like,
right.
It did seem like he was, I mean, didn't deserve to be thrown off a train, maybe. But I don't know. That was where I saw the end for this, was buying into the story of this woman who is unhappy with her wife getting revenge, which of course like changes when you find out that she also killed his wife, which is right. So that's where for me it's like it kind of falls apart, where it's like this witchy stereotype where you have no idea, like why does she start killing people? What is the motivation? What does she get out of it? Who is she? Like, what is her background? And all of these things I feel like would make her a much more accessible character, but it feels like that information is withheld from you by the writers intentionally, so you're just like, this woman is evil in a vacuum. We don't trust her, and she's using sexuality to get what she wants. I don't know, I'm very conflicted about it.
Same.
Yeah, like it's I do understand why the femme fatale trope has been reclaimed and why it hasn't like disappeared, because it's also like I feel like in the 1940s this is like kind of an unusual role where it's an active female character,
right?
Like, that she is involved, like so deeply involved in the plot, and she moves things forward. Everything is her idea for the most part, and it's not like there were a lot of movies at this time where you could see a woman do anything except be mommy or wife, so,
right? Yeah, the femme fatale character, by nature of the narrative that's being told, usually means that that character has way more agency than a lot of female characters that we've seen in like cinema or literature before or since. Like,
right.
And then you could make the argument that it's representation on screen of like a sexually liberated woman and a woman that has sexual autonomy over her own.
Of course, it is evil to be sexually liberated. But...
And that's always where I diverged from a lot of the feminist analysis of this stuff, because I was like, but is it?
Right.
Like, if she's evil and manipulative and we're supposed to think of her like as a bad, you know, like as a bad person, and because women are evil, just because she has like is in tune with her sexuality, I don't think that that's a pro for us as a movement, right? As like feminisms, you know, in general. But I think that there has been a push in feminist film theory specifically to try and kind of wedge in this like sort of positive angle on some of these films that I just don't think works. Like, I don't think that analysis really.
Right. Because when things that we are hoping to see, such as like women having autonomy over their own sexuality, when that is being vilified,
right,
obviously that's not.
It's not a plus for us.
No. You know?
I definitely don't think it's like a movement pushing trope at all. I just understand why people. I feel like it almost, maybe I'm off here, but I feel like it kind of, the impulse to reclaim a sexually liberated woman who's clearly enjoying being evil, it like almost scratches the same itch of reclaiming queer-coded Disney villains, where you're like, okay, this was done with like not a kind intention to the community. Like, this is like, it's clearly vilifying this character, but they're having so much fun and it like they're so active that And also, like, I feel like it's very important that it's like, and this was the most you could get at this time. I think that that has a lot to do with it as well.
Yeah, 100%.
Whereas, like, there just weren't options. Yeah.
I want to just reiterate and agree with you on that of, like, marginalized folks have been desperate for representation at all, and we take the scraps we can get, yeah, right? And we left read and we queer code and we do all kinds of things to feel seen and recognized in a medium, in entertainment in general. So yes, but also it's a problem. Related to this is, I think there's also the other piece of this is around complexity and allowing marginalized characters to be evil or to be messy or to be complicated.
Right.
Because historically we don't really have that, right? That you, like, queer folks are always villainized and Black folks always die. And, you know, like, we have all these tropes that don't come out of nothing, that there is something to be said about the fact that, like, yes, it's kind of cool to be able to see to see women in a character that is more complex than the housewife or the love interest, but it's still detrimental, right? And so holding those two truths in some way, I think, is what makes these conversations so rich and interesting.
Yeah.
Right.
I totally agree. Yeah.
Because this character could have been made to be more complicated in a way that we as the audience could have conflicting feelings about. Like, yes, I understand her motive for wanting to get rid of her husband, and I see where she's coming from. Like, I would identify with that also, but you know, murder also isn't good, so I don't know. But the movie and many of these movies just paint the femme fatale character in these very broad strokes of, like, well, no, her motivations aren't complicated. Her backstory isn't complicated.
She wants to steal. She wants to cheat. She wants to...
Blah, blah, right. Blah, blah, she's blah. Evil for the sake of being evil. And yeah. To me, it comes back to intent as far as, like, the people who were writing these characters. Because, you know, the femme fatale character in film noir specifically, because this archetype has existed in literature for centuries.
The Bible, yeah.
Right, right. But for film noir specifically, it, like you said, Jamie, it was in response to, like, men's anxieties over, you know, empowered women and sexually liberated women, like the flappers of the 20s, and how men felt threatened by that.
Women be voting now.
Right, and because in a patriarchal structure that is designed to disempower women in all capacities of their life, including their sexuality, a sexually empowered woman with agency and autonomy is going to be a threat to a lot of individual men and a threat to the larger structure. So because that's the reason that femme fatales were written that way, in these, like, broad strokes of, like, they're evil, because women are scary and I feel threatened by them.
Right, right.
And also contextually too, remember the early, like, the turn of the century was, like, there was a there was the fight for women's right to vote, which, you know, obviously complicated, and I don't want to erase the racism and everything around that.
Sure.
But also there was a huge battle for birth control and, like, reproductive rights was happening at the time. And there was a huge attempt to squash it. It's so exactly what's happening right now. It's like nothing has changed. But right. You had around that time the postmaster guy, the guy that is really famous guy in the early 1900s who decided to make it illegal to mail anything in the mail that is, like, sexual in nature. So, like, not even sex toys or birth control, but also, like, love letters and photos and all of that kind of stuff.
Oh, my God. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so there is a whole, like, through legal means, a pushback against the rising tide of women's sexuality and sexual ownership and, you know, rights to birth control and all of that that's happening. So that is also informing some of what I think we're seeing in the femme fatale as well.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That's really interesting. That is such a fucked up thing to do. Holy shit.
It is in another one of the episodes coming out of my show.
Really? Oh, I'm excited.
And I'm like, what is this guy's fucking name? I'm totally blanking on it.
Yeah, I don't know. Jamie, you started to touch on something as far as, like, Walter's character goes and how, like, his motive is so flimsy. And
yeah.
To me, it, like,
I'm saying that that was like written intentionally, which I also find confusing.
Maybe in an effort to like just lean into the idea that, oh, women are so scary and beware of any woman who is sexually liberated because she's going to get you and she's going to kill you. I wonder if Walter's character was written the way that it was to just further emphasize that, because again, he doesn't seem to have much of a motive to commit murder. Mm-hmm. It just seems that he's kind of like under the spell of this woman and her quote feminine wiles, where, you know, it's just like this idea that don't be a weak man, weak men are tempted by these temptresses and you'll succumb to the temptation,
right? Which like furthers the argument that she's literally like a variation on a witch,
right?
And like has her anklet has him like doing things he wouldn't normally do. I was also reading that they, I don't know, just a few things were done in this movie intentionally that I guess I just assumed were not done intentionally, including her bad wig. They're like, we chose a bad, Billy Wilder said that they chose a bad wig on purpose to underscore what a sleazy phony she was.
Oh, and my. Like,
I know. It's like measures were taken to really make you hate Phyllis, which I think is fun because in 2021, I watch it and I don't hate her. And I wonder how, if there were women in the audience at this movie, because women have always been the majority moviegoers throughout history. And I wonder if there were women in the audience at this movie that were like, good for her, you know? Like,
right.
You know, but yeah, Walter, I mean, I feel like it is kind of inherent to the noir genre in a way that's kind of frustrating. And I feel like some neo-noirs have course corrected this because it doesn't need to be this way. But like, all the characters are kind of mysterious, or that's what you're told. They're like, oh, everyone's kind of mysterious. You don't know what's going on with anybody. You can't trust anybody. But then what you lose there is like, you don't know anything about anybody. So it's really hard to get attached to any particular character because you're like, well, I guess we'll see what happens. But I don't know like what this person's deal is. I would have loved to understand what drove Phyllis to kill his wife,
right?
I that is like such an important piece of context that would have drawn me into that character's story so much more. But they're just like, well, she's evil, so of course she would do this.
I'm interested in, so like what we've been saying is that neither of them have very good character development,
right?
At least to the standards that we would expect of today.
Sure.
And I think that there is such a reliance on stereotypes of the time. So like this guy, Neff, right, the actor who plays him, Fred McMurray, like we're like, ew, you're fucking awful and terrible and I hate you. But he's probably coming in with all of this like goodwill from the audience that makes them like him more than we have any context for.
Right.
So sure. I know we've covered this, but I'm just thinking about the fact that like there's no character development in this whole fucking movie at all for anybody, right? Like nobody really, you know, you don't really get their motivations. You only get them because of the plot, right? Like the like moment to moment plot of it all. And so what are we bringing as the audience to attach to that? Also, I say this as someone who's like obsessed with character development. And if you don't fucking have it in your movie, I'm just like, get the fuck out of here. Cause like, and I do this all the time.
Which is
and
it's very important.
I'm like, I don't understand why these people love each other. I have no, you did not give me a reason for it. Right. And so in the same way in this, I feel like it didn't matter because like, what an interesting concept this is. What interesting lighting choices were made and what, you know, all of that kind of stuff that would suck an audience in at the time. But why do we still hold on to this as the quintessential epic? You know, like you both talked about how you watched it several times in film school, how it's like the movie. And like, this is the thing that we're teaching young filmmakers is really, really important.
Right.
You know,
it also, and this is something we've talked about on the podcast too, but it's a matter of like, who is designing these curriculums in film schools? Who is curating the lists, like, you know, like the best movies of all time lists that this movie is on, like every fucking one of, like,
who is like members of the Academy, like the, all of that.
Right. Who are the critics historically who have, you know, hailed movies like this? It's again, historically been cishet white men.
With like curriculum too, I feel like there is such a like copy paste effect where it's like, if and this varies, but like if professors were paid, you know, more for their labor and had time to put together their own curriculum and actually like watch shit and like build their own stuff, I feel like you wouldn't have every single college freshman in a film program watching Double Indemnity. But it's just like, oh yeah, I guess this is a movie you watch during the noir section. And so every kid being extorted for money by this big Anyways, I wish I hadn't gone to college. Waste of time.
It's also self-fulfilling, right? Because you were taught that this was really important. Therefore, you're going to teach that it's really important, right?
Like, sure.
And,
yeah.
And I also was thinking about how we often look at film and media in general, music, whatever, from time periods as representative of the time. But they're really not. Like, this is such a good example of that. I'm going to temper that a little bit. Sure. Whereas, like, film up until very recently was not something you could just fucking go do, right? Like, it's not something that you could just like film on your phone and make movies and be like, I have a story to tell and I want to tell it. Mm-hmm. So we're not getting, we don't have the alternative perspectives of in film media specifically of that time period of all the women who are like, fuck yeah, we're like taking over and like doing all of this stuff, right? We're only getting the impressions of the dominant, powerful in the moment, right?
Right.
And I think that I'm just thinking about this now as we're talking, but like how that makes us think that this is what the past was, right? We erase all of the histories of everything else and every other culture and every other like subculture and like groups and that aren't represented in what they were doing. And it makes us in a lot of ways not understand the history of activism, not understand the history of uprising, how change actually happens, because we only have these movies to tell us what it was like. But not only, but you know what I mean? Like,
right. I mean, it's like movies like this that like are the status quo. They maintain the status quo. And then, yeah, everything else just gets pushed to the side and erased. Right. And then we don't learn about them unless we're like, we take it upon ourselves to like dig and find this stuff.
I think that's an excellent transition into the case that that Double Indemnity, the book, was based on, which I did a little bit of light Googling on and found it to be pretty interesting. I feel like we actually had like a recent-ish conversation about this when we did Chicago, because it's kind of dealing with the same era. So and just kind of like how the like when men are adapting the ideas of men or adapting the ideas of men, it's just this like fucked up game of telephone that ends up with like, I have to kill someone because she's got a sexy little anklet. And then it's like, well, let's trace this back to the source of what was actually happening. So this is a screenplay by Billy Wilder and Raymond Chandler. There's a bunch of interesting drama that's not relevant to this show that I just enjoyed reading about.
Yeah.
So it's a screenplay by them based on a novel called Double Indemnity by an author named James M. Cain, who wrote that book when he was a reporter writing about a double indemnity case that he attended as a reporter in 1927. And so I was like, okay, well, what was that crime? And was James Cain, my little hunch was that James Cain made it sexy for no reason and that there was probably something going on.
Oh, Jamie, did you have a hunch? Do you have a little man living inside you that tells you things?
I have a little man and I took up my little magnifying glass and said, let's go to wikipedia.org and see what's going on here. And so that's what I did. So it's a case of a woman named Ruth Snyder from the late 20s who did do the double indemnity thing and killed her husband, Albert Snyder, and went to jail. It's also a case of how brutalizing marginalized people is always going to get a lot of press attention and really exploitative press attention, because she was eventually killed in the electric chair and they published the photo of her being executed on the front page of the newspaper. And it was one of the most famous pictures of the 1920s. So it was absolutely horrific. The reason she committed the crime was not because she was a witch or a sexy little anklet haver. It was because of, and this actually, I guess I feel darkly vindicated, even though I don't know what, you know, what the writers of the movie thought. But
Right.
Her husband was very physically abusive and emotionally abusive, and he abused her because she had a daughter instead of a son, which gender is a construct and no one has fucking control over that. Uh-huh. He had like pictures of his ex-fiance hanging up around their house and refused to take them down. Like, it just sounded like an extremely emotionally and physically volatile, abusive relationship. And so eventually she double indemnitied and she killed the motherfucker. And I just thought that was such a, it's frustrating. And I think it's interesting that you can take a story that tragic and upsetting and turn it into, well, of course she was evil and we can't mm-hmm. even take her at her word that her husband was being abusive because she can't be trusted. And she's, you know, like,
you know what? If it is based on that, I bet you her husband abusing her is actually real in the movie, but they didn't do any due diligence of making that established, right?
Sure, like, yeah.
You sort of like brushed upon this, but this idea of sensationalizing marginalized grief and bodies, and I think that that's a really critical piece of all of this, is that like, while women are dainty and nonviolent and don't do these things, and therefore, holy shit, they did this thing. Isn't that like sensational and cool and interesting and newsworthy, mm-hmm. right? And that is also gender essentialism, right? We're talking about
sure.
You know, like, all humans are capable of all things, right? We all have the same, right. I mean, not all, you know what I mean, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. But because patriarchy says that women aren't these things, it's really interesting if we imagine women to be all of these, you know, things in terms of violent and murderous and whatever, what have you.
Right.
Not to erase the fact that there is already patriarchy dictating that women are manipulative and conniving and all of that. But,
right.
you know, that it's just another piece of why I think these stories get sensationalized. And they still do. Right.
Sure.
They still do. Like, we love women as victims. We love like brutalized, like true crime. You know, we're not even going to get into the nightmare that is true crime currently. And we love a female villain. Because it still seems like something outside of the norm.
Mm. Right. I think writers justify continuing to like use the tropes because it's like, well, it's interesting. It's cinematic. These are interesting characters. It also makes me wonder, at least, how much more sexualized and sinister femme fatale characters in film noir would have been during this era if it weren't for the restrictions of the production code. Like, how much worse could it be? Right.
Yeah.
I mean, but the answer is the women in the 90s. Yeah. Like action heroes, female 90s action heroes. Right. I've been rewatching all the Terminator movies because we're doing an episode on the Terminator franchise on Feminist Frequency Radio. You can check out my podcast.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, Terminator 3 had a female Terminator. And like, there's a scene where she sees a billboard with a woman with larger breasts. So then they like pan to her boobs and she makes them bigger so she can like get, so she can manipulate the cop into letting her go when she was speeding. And you're just like, one, this is such a product of its time, but that's what this would have been. It would have been some kind of equivalent to the sexy, you know, hypersexualized, using feminine wiles to get what you want, right?
That's true.
Yeah. Or like Basic Instinct.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
like Sharon Stone's just like, here's my vagina. Now you'll never, you won't even notice that I'm a murderer.
And again, it's like, it's interesting to me historically that the femme fatale trope makes that big comeback in the 90s because it's like a similar era of feminist backlash, and so it's like that is when
hugely.
This trope pops, is when women's rights are being actively set back. So, you know, look out for that. If a femme fatale starts to pop, guess what? We're about to lose some rights, which we're doing anyways.
That whole like mid-90s to aughts time period was all the like ironic sexism and ironic racism time period. So it was part of the backlash of like coming off of the 80s, the conservative family values messaging that was being pushed by the conservative establishment. And right. then you had all yeah. of this, like, but we're beyond sexism. So now you get those Carl's Jr. commercials where women are like eating uh-huh. the burgers and like cum is running down their faces and all that shit. That all comes out of that moment.
They're
and
like, that's funny. Remember this?
Yeah.
You're like, I don't remember this.
Like, I made a really, really early feminist frequency video. I'm sure it's embarrassing as fuck now about ironic sexism and how,
yeah.
like South Park is 100% this. And so that was when we got all of those female action heroes that, like, you know, the reboot of Charlie's Angels and, mm-hmm. You know, like all of that stuff where they're so cringy and hard to watch. But yeah. it was yeah. women's empowerment, the Spice Girls and all that shit, you know, girl power.
Girl right. power. Oh, yeah. We said yeah. girl power feminism.
Yeah.
yeah, this is, I'm so glad. I was really hoping that this would be the way that this episode would go and we would just get into it. I'm very excited.
I just feel like this movie has more for us to talk about in terms of the relevance of what this movie means to us today than the like actual content of this movie.
Than versus what's happening. Yeah, it's like, I totally agree. And I just want to, the last thing I had about femme fatales, I just like, I don't know, it's just such interesting timing, but like how this trope of just like, an empowered woman is a dangerous woman. We've had so many conversations about that and how it easily translates to like so many witch characters, even like recent witch characters. It's just like coding a woman as competent and therefore evil and therefore unlovable and therefore like not the protagonist under any circumstances, uh-huh. which I don't know. I mean, with the femme fatale, I mean, I would argue that Walter doesn't feel like the protagonist of this movie to me because I don't care about him, but maybe that's just personal. But anyways, as far as the femme fatale trope went to, Caitlin, you referenced this earlier, but it goes back to ancient times. Like we mm-hmm. are addicted to othering any marginalized person, but in this trope specifically, women. And the only like growth in the trope in this era of Hollywood is that the femme fatales are more active now. There used to be like the earliest examples of the femme fatale trope are like women who are just being told they're evil just because. So like you have like your Helen of Troy's where they're like, she's so hot that we had to have a war about it. Like right. they're completely passive on top of it. So I'm like, I guess I prefer an active femme fatale. But even so, I mean, it's just, especially with the context of like the case that trickles down to this movie, mm-hmm. it's just like, well, clearly it just couldn't be more obvious that there should not be exclusively men telling this story, because if you go back to the source, it's so much more complicated and mm-hmm. like having those two or three bits of context completely changes the way you would view that character or that person, Ruth Snyder, who was abused and exploited right. on the other end of being abused to the point where her corpse was in the fucking newspaper. Like that stuff makes me so mad.
Just to call out, like women who have murdered their partners, mostly male partners, mm-hmm. In self-defense or because of abusive relationships yeah. or what have you, like are rotting in jail. Like that it's still not
mm-hmm. and it's disproportionately black and brown women who are absolutely. Incarcerated for it. It's just like it's
yes
but no Phyllis was Anklet. She was evil. She's bad.
She just kills everybody for reasons.
But I love watching Barbara Stanwyck, so it's hard.
Right.
Anyways,
can we talk a little bit about Lola?
Yeah, let's talk about Lola.
I don't really know what to make of her because we only get to see her in a few brief scenes. We learn that she's dating this guy, Nino Zucchetti, who
is a good
real
character
piece
name.
Of work. It's a good character name.
I have no friend.
He's an asshole. She's in love with him. We don't learn her age in the movie, but again, according to the screenplay, she's 19.
Okay.
Then basically Walter gaslights her and coerces her into a brief relationship, which seems to work because she kind of like magically forgets all about her suspicions that her stepmother probably killed her father, which she is right about. But because she's being manipulated by Walter, the story has her forget about that.
Right.
So, I mean, that to me, just this just feels like another just female character in the movie who's not a femme fatale, but who is wildly underwritten and who the story has her make some confusing choices. And again, like, I'm not blaming her for being manipulated and coerced by Walter, but a lot of her choices and just kind of the way she was characterized didn't track for me. And also because we don't learn anything about her.
I think I kind of like half stopped paying attention around this point in the movie. Not intentionally, just in the way that that happens when you're sitting at home. Sure. And I totally like, I don't think you're wrong, but I did not read it as him manipulating Lola. I just read it as like creepy, like getting away from Phyllis. And like, because all that stuff was revealed about Nino, that like he was just moving in that way. But now I'm like, oh, that makes so much more sense. He was trying
He literally says, like, in his voiceover, he's like, I couldn't let her tell anyone else about her suspicions.
No, you're totally
so
right.
So I took her to the beach and I took her for some French fries. He's like basically saying, like, I hung out with her to distract her.
And then it seems like she might have like developed a crush. It's like, it seems like she develops a crush on him, or at very least, he is presenting himself in a position of authority. And I feel like he's like not just leveraging his age and his gender, he's also leveraging his job over her. He's like, well, I'm an insurance guy, so that's like, he's gaslighting her in the grounds of like, well, I know what I'm talking about, you're just a kid, like what do you know.
Okay, then was Nino sleeping with Phyllis, or was she manipulating him to like to sort of put a button on this whole murder thing?
My read was that that relationship might have been a bit more like mutually consensual, but because Phyllis is characterized as this like very textbook femme fatale, that she was manipulating him, and maybe just she was maybe just like setting up a few different fall guys so that she wasn't so culpable. But that didn't make sense to me either. Like, her relationship with him, I didn't understand why that was happening.
Maybe we missed something, and maybe like listeners are like frothing right now, they're like, it's so obvious. But like, yeah, I sort of was like, I was like, oh, I guess by the end of a noir you just have to find out that everybody secretly knew each other the whole time or something. Like, it just felt very like genre-y. I wasn't totally clear on that either.
Yeah.
But also, if this is the blueprint, like, if this movie is the blueprint,
right,
then this movie created some fucked up blueprints. You know?
Yeah, you're totally. Like, it's kind of a confusing blueprint. But I do, I mean, Lola, I feel like she's definitely underwritten. And it sucks because I feel like the early scenes with Lola, I was kind of like gently encouraged by, because as I said at the beginning, I didn't think there was going to be a second woman in the movie. So I was like thrilled that I was like, oh, there's a... Also, that cutting thing where Phyllis was like, yeah, and he just loves his daughter so much. I was like, Phyllis, give it a rest. I assumed that they were talking about a child, and so, but they were talking about a 19-year-old, whatever. But I do like that Lola, like when Lola's introduced, I liked how her character was introduced. She like pushed back on, like, her dad was like, who are you going to see? What are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. Like doing kind of the stereotypical controlling father thing.
Right.
And she like lies to his face very calmly. She's like, this is what I'm doing. I'm going to this intersection and like, goodbye. And I was like, oh, I like this character. She's fun. Like she's, I feel like it's unusual, especially in 1944 for the first interaction you see with a female character for them to stand up for themselves in some way. But then it's like that slowly, and I also like that she is the person that sees through everything that's going on, which makes it like more disappointing and shitty to see her talked out of what she knows is the truth for the rest of the movie, and then she disappears.
Right.
I was rooting for her.
Same. Justice for Lola.
And now she's lost all of her parents.
I don't know. She's a 19-year-old orphan. Like,
but I guess in a way, she's also presented as an obstacle for Walter because she starts having suspicions and he's got to deal with it. So she's undercharacterized and she's presented as an obstacle the way that many women are in movies.
Right.
Wouldn't it be so cool if she like was the one that solved it?
Right. I was like, that would have been awesome.
You know, like if they just did this like spin at the end where she came around and was like, let me tell you, I figured it all out and now I'm going to extort you all for something, you know?
I would have loved that.
Or I wish that she had showed up and killed Phyllis, because it's like she and Phyllis had such a terrible relationship. Phyllis literally killed her mother. They didn't want to play Chinese checkers together. Like, it would have been cool if Lola came back at the end and like killed them both and then was like, all right, Zacchetti, let's go make you a friend or like whatever. But instead, the only like, you know, bow you're sort of given on her thing is like, oh, and she'll probably get to date this asshole again because Walter tells Zacchetti, like, hey, call Lola back. She likes you. And I was like, oh, great. What a win. I get to date a man with no friends again.
Also, that whole scene, I was like, he's gonna know that you did it. Like that whole scene, I was like, he pops out of the bushes and is like, go hang out with Lola. And you're like, wow, you just outed yourself big time, buddy.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
Not a good move.
They're so bad at planning.
Walter's not a smart guy. He's.
I also don't understand how what Neff does to kill Mr. Dietrichson. I think he strangles him, but like, wouldn't the autopsy show that he was strangled and not fell off of a train? So like their plan is just like very, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. Also, Walter's plan to communicate with Phyllis as they're like creating their scheme is for her to go to a shop every day and, quote, be buying things every day at 11 a.m. And if he needs to talk to her that day, he'll just like show up when it's convenient for him, because women be shopping. She has to go be shopping all the time, every day. And then he'll be like,
and he might not even show up. Yeah.
And he might show. And also part of this is that he's like, we have to go to this shop because we can't be seen talking to each other. So his idea is to meet in public where people can see them talking to each other.
But they're like shopping, so they're not really talking to each other, you know? Yeah, that's really funny. And also, those are really interesting scenes, too, in terms of the sterileness of it and like the brightness of those shots. And like, you know, like we didn't really talk about any of the visuals in the movie, but they're, you know, anyways, whatever.
Right.
I feel like that is like a large portion of why these movies are still well regarded, is because they look really fucking cool. Like they're
the shadow play in this and the like shadows. Yes.
Yeah.
That's good.
Mm-hmm. My favorite line in the movie was when Keys said, Papa has it all figured out. I jumped in my seat. I was like, this guy is weird. I like him.
Speaking of Keys, the one part of the movie that I was like, oh, this isn't the worst thing I've ever seen, is where I think once, maybe even twice, Walter tells Keys, which is a colleague of his, but they're also like close friends. Walter tells Keys that he loves him, and just like a very like, we have a close relationship, and we're not led to believe that it's anything more than platonic, but like, I just really enjoyed seeing like a man tell another man that he loves him, mm-hmm. because that's not something you see very often, and certainly not in this era where, you know, men are conditioned to think that like even a platonic affection toward another man is
yeah.
gross or something. Who knows? But
they were friends.
I was like, wow, they were friends and they loved each other.
Too bad that Walter's the most boring man alive and Keys participated in the Red Scare, but you know,
yikes.
they were friends.
The last thing I wanted to mention is something that's very typical of this era, which is the representation of people of color in the movie, which is that they are only seen very fleetingly and always in like service roles, like train porters yeah. and, you know, wait staff and things like that.
Well, there was one character I wrote a note being like, there's a character from Inglewood that kind of looked like he was in brownface. And I was like, what the fuck is this?
No.
I did wonder about that.
Gorlapis or something.
Mm-hmm. In that early scene. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, oh, this is not good.
Yeah. Hard to say, but representation of people of color is
scarce.
Has always been bad, and then as in this era especially is
I would like to take that on in a future episode as well. Like, we should continue to pursue this conversation
for sure. Absolutely. Does anyone have anything else they want to talk about regarding Double Indemnity?
No, when are we going to do it? Let's do a double indemnity. Ooh, let's like have a little heist crew and kill someone's shitty husband
a good
for
idea.
Monies.
Mm. What are they going to do? Put us in the electric chair and then put it in the newspaper? It wouldn't happen.
Yes. That will be our claim to fame. Feminist podcasters do the ultimate.
Feminist podcasters get the electric chair for thought crimes.
Feminist? More like... Femme fatalinist.
Oh, nice. Wow. Nice one. Yep. I think we're going to get the electric chair just for that. not that we should be joking about how awful fucking what's it called when the state murders you? State murder?
Capital punishment?
Yeah, capital punishment. That's right.
This movie does pass the Bechdel test, though.
Yes.
It does when Lola and Phyllis are talking about how they don't want to play Chinese checkers with each other.
Yeah. Lola says, "Do you mind if we don't finish this game? It bores me stiff." And then Phyllis says, "You got something better to do?" And that, woohoo! I think those
feminist
are the only
win.
Those are the only two. That's the only example of an exchange between two women.
And don't worry, they hate each other.
I mean, I guess it does. That conversation is there to establish that they don't like each other, but the text itself is like not narratively meaningful. So to me, it's like a barely pass.
It's a barely pass, but I think it's a funny barely pass because it's just a right. hostile exchange between the only two women in the movie.
Woo-hoo.
Yay.
As far as our nipple scale, though, on a scale of 0 to 5 nipples, based on how well the movie fares when examining it through an intersectional feminist lens, I'll give it a half nipple for the following reasons. That we see a woman have more agency than a lot of women have been able to have in movies. Of course, that agency is vilified and we are not meant to empathize with this character at all. And instead, we are meant to see her as an evil temptress, which is how, unless, you know, there are a few examples of like a subversion of the femme fatale trope that, you know, have happened in more recent films. But especially of this era, there was no nuance, there was no complexity in general to the femme fatale archetype. And even though, like we discussed, there have been maybe some attempts to reclaim the archetype, I don't...
It's not in the text of this movie, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work for me, especially with the intent of the storytellers and villainizing an empowered and sexually liberated woman. Don't like it. I'll give the movie 1/2 nipple, and I'll give it to Lola, who deserved more justice for Lola.
I guess I'll give it 1 question mark. I do think that this is like the most active female character that you could find in movies at this time, unfortunately. I am a little more pro reclaiming, and I think that it has been semi-successfully reclaimed in more recent neo-noir efforts simply by giving a woman who does something bad context and motivation, which is like, I feel like what is really, really missing here, especially with the context of knowing what the source material is and how it's, like Anita was saying, like this movie is presenting a reality that we are told existed but never did. Like no one was ever acting in a void like this. Witches are not
right.
a thing. But I do appreciate how active the villainous woman is throughout. And also Lola, I mean, she has a strong start and then I feel like she's kind of like neutered by this story, which I found frustrating and unnecessary. Yeah, I mean, like because of the era, it is extremely white and straight and and we didn't really talk about this, but the whole idea of like you're kind of told at the end that the great tragedy of this story is that it turns out that Phyllis could love after all, and you're like, who gives a shit? Like and there's like this last minute production code style, like the redemptive power of a love between a man and a woman and blah, blah, blah. Like it's just, I guess I'm bumping it down to a half nipple and I'm giving that half nipple to the line, Papa has it all figured out.
Beautiful. Anita, how about you?
I don't think I can add anything to what y'all said, so I'm just going to piggyback on that. But I just, I'm going to give my, if I'm going to give my rating to somebody, my non-existent rating, it's going to be to the line, hope there aren't any pigeons shitting on you while you're sunbathing, because I can't get over that.
Oh, love it. So wait, zero nipples? Is that what you're giving it?
No, I'm just going to, I think the half nipple is a good one.
Yeah, okay,
I agree with what both of you said.
Nice. Well, Anita, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Come back anytime. Tell us where people can follow you on social media, plug anything you would like to plug.
Yeah, so you can follow me on the social medias at Anita Sarkeesian. And one of the things I do is I run a emotional support hotline for people who make or play games. It's called the Games and Online Harassment Hotline. So if you need a little emotional support and you live in the U.S., you can text us. You can learn more at gameshotline.org. Our agents are trained in understanding like internet culture and gaming culture and online harassment as well. So if you're, you know, even if you don't play games and you need a little bit of help around some of this stuff, we're here for you. Mm-hmm. So gameshotline.org. We're also in the middle of our end of year fundraising campaign for the hotline and everything else that Feminist Frequency does to try to end abuse in the video game industry. So if you want to pitch in a couple bucks to that, feel free. In addition to your Patreon support of the Bechdel cast, right? Because there's no, we got to share. There's no scarcity here. So, or it's all scarce, you know, one or the other. Right. You can learn more at gameshotline.org. You can check me out at Anita Sarkeesian on all the things. Oh, also my podcast, Feminist Frequency Radio. Yeah. If you like this, you'll like what we do. Yeah.
Hell yeah. Give that a listen, everybody. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Bechdelcast. And speaking of that, Patreon, aka Matreon, you can find that at patreon.com/Bechdelcast. You get 2 bonus episodes every month, plus access to all of the previously released bonus episodes, of which there are over 100. So check it out.
Look at them go. Really putting in the time. You better join. And if you have any merch related needs, we've got you there too. You can go to teepublic.com/thebechdelcast and get all of your, guess what's in season right now? Baby Grinch
baby
t-shirts.
Grinch. So
there you go. Get your Baby Grinch t-shirts. And I guess now's the time where we shoot each other. Let's shoot each other and kiss.
No, you pushed us off a train.
Oh, sorry. We definitely pushed.
But not really. We're going to just pretend. Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty good mystery, right? I mean, I know we're done talking about it, but I'm like, that's a pretty good scheme. I was like, cool. I'm on board with this.
Yeah, except that they executed badly.
The execution. The idea was good.
Yeah.
I maintain the idea was good. The execution, they clearly were ill-equipped.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, y'all. Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure talking with both of you.
The pleasure is all ours.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
You can't fully understand the moment we're living in without knowing where we've been. On every episode of NPR's Throughline, we take a story from the news and go back in time to where it started, where it really started. To answer one important question, how did we get here? Find NPR's Throughline on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s,
she looked like $1 million,
scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes.
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.